Good morning, everyone. My name is Don Gates, an alcoholic. That was quite an impressive roll call. I'm not going to repeat each name. I noticed several people enigmatically identified themselves only as visitors, but I want you to know that these tapes are given to the Tulare Vice Squad anyhow. I'm truly impressed with the number of people. Everyone said there was a conference or convention or something going on in Fresno and that no one would be here except the sincere ones who were out of gas. Very impressive, actually. I've enjoyed the little stay. We took a short jaunt just before the meeting, partly to test Ernest's faith as to whether we would return or not, but we wanted to take a look at the town. It's very distracting, certainly at this time of the year when everything is green and verdant. We're looking around for Steve Garvey High School, but apparently it's been turned into a nursery. I guess that's what comes when you play for the Padres. I had rather hoped that I would have an audience unfamiliar with my various monologues. I've been speaking in Alcoholics Anonymous, drunk and sober, for 31 years. And these words do not come glittering de novo from my lips on each occasion. There's a tendency to repeat. But I had not been to this particular area, and I thought I would be reasonably safe. But a number of people came up and started talking about tapes they had heard. And it's a strange thing. You can travel across the country and think you're going to get a virgin audience. Instead, people come up and tell you things about yourself that your mother doesn't know. Apparently, there is no hiding place with this tape system. Just before I got up, I actually had looked around the audience and saw that most of the people here were adults, as compared to Los Angeles, where we have an extraordinary number of young people, and the gentleman seated beside me mentioned how young the attractive lady who read the traditions was. It's hard to believe anybody that young is an alcoholic. And I thought, isn't that strange how we get that attitude? It isn't perfectly true. I was speaking at a meeting someplace the other day, and the person I was with, I looked around, the typical young people type meeting in Los Angeles, and I said to the person who had driven down with me, this is without question the youngest bunch of people I have ever seen. And this cold-hearted soul said, no, that isn't it. You've just never been this old before. You know, and that's really true. A fellow that we know there in Los Angeles, he's from West Hollywood, a gay guy, and he was telling me how he was always attracted to older men until one day he looked around and found there were none. And that's true. It's kind of disheartening at times. I was speaking at a clubhouse there in the San Fernando Valley some year or two ago, a place called The Nest. It's a place where if you still want to associate with lower companionship while sober, you can attend. I happened to get off on some particularly inspirational pitch or something, and afterwards all of the young people swarmed around to touch the hem of my garment, and except one young girl, and she hung back. And I noticed her, and I realized that she probably felt the need for individual healing. And perhaps the laying on of hands. And it proved true when the multitude had melted away. She came forward and spake unto me, saying, "That was so beautiful, and you remind me so much of my grandfather." Father, you might overcome. Grandfather, not a chance. The time has flown, actually. I said 31 years. That's 33 years, I guess, I've been speaking in AA. And as someone mentioned here before, that doesn't indicate that I have been unbrokenly sober for 33 years. The reason I don't remember offhand how many birthdays I've had is that I don't count them anymore. When I first came around, I used to really keep track of my birthdays. One, two, one, two, one, two. I couldn't get through that third year. But it's been 25 years now, and I stopped counting once I decided I was going to be sober indefinitely. It really is astounding how long you can stay sober if you don't drink. In those early years, when I was venturing forth to test the hypothesis, people would tell me various cures or problems. They would say, "Don, you have to get active, work with a newcomer." And I would drag them in off the bar stools, ready or not. And I'd still have trouble. And they would say, "Well, you've got to be more deeply into self-analysis." And I would take out rod and reel and go up the stream of consciousness looking for character defects. And I'd still have trouble. I'd say, "You have to get more spiritual." And I would pursue God up and down the byways of the San Fernando Valley, and I'd still have trouble. And as I say, a little over 25 years ago, I decided to quit drinking. I had no trouble with this. Because the program really is so extraordinarily simple and so direct. In fact, if you weren't handicapped with a degree in psychology, and someone were to say to you, "What do you think causes alcoholism?" I warrant you would come up with the correct surmise instantly. Alcohol. Now that has escaped the attention of a great many people. They ascribe it to virtually everything but booze. Twisted childhood. Failure to close an Oedipus triangle. Improper bowel training. The decline of any bourgeois capitalism. In some quarters, the only thing that isn't suspect is alcohol. And yet, as a practical matter, if alcohol had never been invented, there wouldn't be one alcoholic on the face of the earth characterized by any such label. Because I have yet to see an alcoholic suffer from a single emotional, psychiatric abnormality that the non-alcoholic does. You know, we sometimes come in and flagellate ourselves till there isn't a shred of flesh left on our back, talking about our inadequacies and our screwy problems, and describing them as alcoholism. And they're not. You know, those are just the things that flesh are heir to. Any problem that you have, or any hang-up that you have, there's nine others out there just like you, except they're not alcoholics. You know, they're non-alcoholics. We almost describe them sometimes as if they were normal, healthy, well-adjusted people. If you think the non-alcoholic world is in that condition, you have not been outdoors very much. You haven't read a newspaper, looked at a TV set. The non-alcoholic world is stark, raving, lunatic crazy. And they never have to change. Nothing ever happens to them. They go through life clinging to those dubious luxuries of resentment and self-pity and getting even and paying back. I watch them downtown where I work, and they walk around their knuckles white and their jaws tense. Gonna get that bitch on the stand, make her admit she's an unfit mother right in front of the children. Nothing ever happens to them. They just go through life in quiet desperation, getting locked up, owners, and destroying all pleasures. But that's not significant. No moment. Nobody's ever been arrested for driving while pissed off. You don't get picked up for being a common mope, whining and disorderly. But we do, and therefore we have to do something about it. They don't. You know, and it's hard. The longer you're sober, and of course, the more you're away from the drinking world, it's difficult to visualize both what alcoholics and non-alcoholics are like. My wife and I took a trip. We were speaking up in Oregon. Instead of flying up there, we decided to take the train. And I hadn't been on a train since the war. Second World War. And they've improved them enormously. They now have these two-story view passenger ones. And they've broken them down into little compartments. Well, they probably have a regular coach too, but a lot of them are those little compartments. They have two seats facing each other, comfortable enough so that when they break them down at night, there's a bed here, and then they drop it down a bed above it. It gives you privacy and quiet, and it's an extraordinarily pleasant drive. But apparently, in order to compete with the airlines and their champagne flights and things, when we got on, the porter gave us a little basket of cheeses and crackers and a small flight in a wine shaped flight and about the same size as your fist. You know, and we couldn't believe it. Two people were supposed to have a party for something that wouldn't have made a decent gulp. Can you imagine that? That was supposed to be a festive occasion for two. In a compartment of two or three down from us, however, there was a real drinking man. He obviously had brought his own. He was not going to be restricted with government issues. Because sometime during the night, he had gotten sufficiently intoxicated that he had thrown up all over that little compartment, you know, and then slept in it. And he had to explain it to the porter in the morning. I think I could explain this. Isn't that the light? Kind of makes you miss social drinking, doesn't it? The fun of it all. Reminded me, I had a peripatetic friend who used to come to L.A. and he'd sober up for a few months or so, and then he would take off again on some crazy adventure. And when he came back, he always had the wildest stories to tell, and they were true. He would bring newspaper clippings to prove them. But I, for some reason, talking about that fellow in the compartment reminded me, one time he'd gone up to Alaska, and when he came back, he had talked himself into any kind of a job, and he came back and he'd been working up there as a deep sea diver for some company. I don't know how he got into it, but he was deep sea diving. And this was back before the scuba days, you know, when they had the big iron helmets and the boots and so on. And according to him, I don't know if it's true or not, but according to him, you controlled your air pressure down there and your movements up and down by pushing a valve with your chin. And he said, Don, that oxygen that you get pumped in, that pressure is different than we used to get up in the air for. You know, you can almost get over a hangover taking that straight oxygen at altitude. But he said, down there in that bottom of the ocean, that pressure, the air that comes in, makes you extraordinarily nauseous. And he said, if you haven't lived until you've got a hangover, down about 50 fathoms and you vomited inside that little house. And then the only way you can come up is to rub your face in it. Doesn't it kind of make you wish you could drink and have fun? It really is. The longer I've been away from it, the harder it is for me to visualize the drinking meat. But there's nothing wrong that I have seen with the alcoholic faculties. He's simply physiologically different than other people. He experiences something that they don't. But it has nothing to do with his mentality. In fact, alcohol is such a vile commodity. It's about as terrible a thing as you can put in your mouth and survive, really. You occasionally hear a person who hasn't reflected on it too much, they'll say, I enjoyed the taste of a good bourbon. Can you imagine that? Remember what that bourbon tasted like? I'm not talking now about mixed drinks where you slop it up where it isn't worthwhile. I'm talking about drinking good hot tin high out of a paper sack. So the cops won't know what's in it. And remember that first drink. You never felt you got cheated to tin high. Hit your stomach with a nauseating splash, you know, and everything in you wanted to throw it back up again. Because it's a poison. You know, that's where the word intoxicated comes from. It comes from the word toxic. Toxic means poison. And if you drink enough of a poison, you become intoxicated. That's where it comes from. So your body naturally wants to throw it up again. But if you can just hold it down, and you take that big drink, I'm not the first drink. I'm not talking about the fourth, fifth. Hell, you can drink horse urine and then it wouldn't matter. I'm talking about that first drink. Involuntary tremble, you know, like a man leaving a urinal. That's it. Now, if you can just hold it down, then you can pour a whole lot more on top of it and you get the dry heat and diarrhea. Maybe it does reflect on our intelligence a little bit. But I once saw a program on the channel, the PBS channel in our area, and it happened to say we're giving IQ tests to the lower forms of animal life to find out how they rank on an intelligence quotient scale. And you can't give a written test, obviously a verbal test, to animals. So they devised various tests, non-verbal, because they had decided, and made a certain amount of tests, that the surest indication of intellect is the ability to learn from experience. And so they would put these little creatures, mice or other animals, into mazes and things, and test how many times they would keep going up the wrong road into some dead end, it's called a cul-de-sac, before they found the route through. And they would score them. And I watched it, that was interesting. They ranked a little bit differently than I would have thought. And then I would have assumed I would forget it as I do all other things. But it kept nagging at me. And that usually means there's something I haven't yet quite perceived that I should apply to myself. And then I got thinking about this drinking, what it was like. Because as a result of a fever I had during the war years, whenever I drank, that's what happened to me. Dry heaves and diarrhea. My first spiritual experience on this program was a solid bowel movement. Now, I don't understand why people titter at that. You must be made of sterner stuff. If you had that malady, you wouldn't giggle, I'll tell you. In fact, you know, I wake up in the morning, run into the John, being undecided which end to point, I splatter two walls. I'm nothing weak about myself. And if you've had that malady, only then probably will you know the rise in self-esteem, the sense of manhood, and even of virility that comes over you the first time you're able to break wind without fear of following through. I mean, that alone should give you a birthday cake. And yet, vomiting as a way of life had no appeal to me. Diarrhea, except insofar as it keeps you on the move, is not an aim. And I thought, yes, every time I drank whiskey, that's what happened to me. Within a couple of days, I was in that condition. And stayed that way, as long as I continued to drink. And I thought, isn't that astonishing? Because that didn't happen to me just once or twice. I would like to think if I tried that during the whiskey and got that result consistently, I'd quit it. But it didn't happen to me 5 times or 50 times or 500 times or 5,000 times. I don't know how many it happened every single time. And I never made the connection. And I thought, my God, that's why that IQ test disturbed you. And the ability to learn from experience is the test, you would come in somewhere below a retarded turtle. Just astonishing. But even so, the reason we don't make that connection is that the taking of the drink is not followed by that phenomenon. I didn't get sick while drinking. It would be when I woke up in the morning. I associated taking a drink with a rush of euphoria, a rush of well-being. It was waking up in the morning that caused the trouble, and I attributed that to sleeping. But the non-alcoholic, think of them, how strange they are. I mean, they take a drink of this vile substance, God, it's awful, and expensive. And yet the moment it begins to do that which God and man designed it to do, they quit. My whole family, my relatives are non-alcoholic as far as I know. They'll take a drink. In fact, they tricked me a couple of times. They'd go to one of their houses and they'd say, come on in, we'll have a drink. And as we cross the portal, you know, they'd say, we'll have a drink before dinner. And they mean that. One drink and then they're going to sit down and eat dinner. Can you imagine that? I mean, they tricked me several times. I didn't believe they were serious. But I never wanted a drink before anything. Oh, I think if somebody would say, would you like a shot while I'm mixing your drink? And on a festive occasion, the ladies might take two, three even. And their eyes glow. Their toes need a tattoo on the carpet. But if you say, well, you have another, then, oh, no, I'm beginning to feel it. Now think of the logic that underlies that observation. It's beginning to work, so they quit. I mean, if there's any help for such people, it lies outside our organization. I mean, we have our foibles and our hang-ups, but we're not utterly devoid of logic or reason. When we drink intoxicants, by golly, we become intoxicated. But I knew there were a number of Al-Anons identified during that roll call, and I don't mean to assault you. With a, you're not at fault. You seem to have been born that way. It is amazing, really. The alcoholism in some ways is so utterly simple, and yet perhaps because of it, it's harder for us to identify. And we're told such nonsense about it. Now, the non-alcoholic will even say of us sometimes, trouble with you alcoholics, you're lacking in willpower. You know why they say that? They think we want to stay sober. If they had any idea what our true goal was, they would stand in rapt awe at our dedication and perseverance. What do they have in the pursuit of the gates of insanity or death, huh? Nothing. Can't be asked. Well, obviously alcohol does to us physiologically something that it doesn't do to the non-alcoholic, and it would be silly of anyone to give up if it does that for them until they've had enough, until it no longer works, until the pain associated with drinking greater than the pleasure. I mean, isn't that the object of life, to maximize pleasure and minimize pain? So if it's working, fine. The only thing is, of course, that it ceases to work for most of us long, long before we recognize it. We still remember what it was like in the beginning. That's why our portion of chapter 3 that talks about the great obsession, that somehow, someday, we're going to control and enjoy our drinking. We remember what it used to be like. I guess that I wasn't, I don't ordinarily tell stories from my drinking years anymore because they, frankly, they bore me, but also they don't really tell what I was like. I wasn't like that. When you first come around, and in fact some people today under the guise of knowing what they used to be like, get up and give you a drunkalogue, virtually asserting, if not certainly implying, that they did those things on purpose. I didn't. I didn't do any of those things. They happened to me. No, I didn't plan them. I didn't plan to be an alcoholic. Never walked into some counselor's office and said, I think I'd like to major in vomiting, minor in diarrhea. Hell, I never planned an evening the way it went. I hear people get up and say, I can't blame the things I did while drinking on the flip. I think, oh, you poor pathetic devil, that's a tragedy, I can. I blame damn near every rotten thing that happened to me on drinking. I didn't plan it that way. I never had an evening go the way I wanted. I never said to myself, well, let's see, what'll we do? It's Friday night, I've got about a pint here in the house, and I think I'll kill that, then I'll go out and total the car. I just canceled the insurance to save money. Perhaps on the way to the hospital, the ambulance and will roll me so I'll have no identification. And I just I can spend 24 hours being humiliated down in general, but I'll be able to cut the jug on the way home, and I can terrorize the wife and children all day Sunday afternoon. I mean, it's self-evident from the moment I arose that I was far too distinguished, urbane, and sophisticated to do a thing like that, but it happened to me. Maybe that's part of why we do identify to an extent. I don't particularly, but generally we have a people get up and tell drunk logs. And I think the reason in part that works is that during our drinking years, as the problems were increasing and we were trying to get others to stop drinking for us, we would go to various men of the cloth or learned in the medicine and psychiatric fields, and they could probably to some extent understand us, empathize with us, but they were not like us, and they talked down to us. Pity the poor devil crushed by the juggernaut demon rum. And one thing we won't tolerate is being talked down to. I mean, we can lie flat in our face in the gutter and look down on others. Now you come into AA, no one talks down to you. In fact, they don't even talk about you. They talk about themselves incessantly. And they never say anything about you, or even listen. Yeah, I can remember one of my early meetings. A guy was talking about how insane he became in his drinking years. He said, I'll tell you how bad I was, how utterly crazy I was. I used to keep a bottle of wine under my bed at night. So if I needed a drink, I didn't even have to make the run to the kitchen. I could just reach right under the bed and grab it. I thought, that's a strange example of lunacy. I do that. In fact, I remember the time I'd been working as a translator down in Montevideo in Uruguay, and I was living in a pension that wasn't entirely first cabin, four star, sanitary, and I had my bottle of vino under the bed. And during the night, a little La Cucaracha, a little cockroach, came in, perhaps attracted by the smell of the sweet, fresh grape. And he found the bottle, scaled its glassy side, finding it uncorked, he fell in. And about 4:35 in the morning, in utter blackness, I awoke with a burning in my throat as a result of something I hadn't eaten for 3 days. And reached under the bed, grabbed that bottle, took a full shot, that little beastie. Isn't that repulsive? Wholesome. I really was so disgusted, I almost threw the rest of the bottle away. But he hadn't said a thing about me. He didn't say anything about me, so come about himself. And if you will do those three simple things, you will find a fight. You will know a life free of financial insecurity. enjoy sexual pleasure. Virtually unendurable and interminable. Thank you. Let's see, you worked that out. I probably... I'll tell one story. Somebody who had tape asked me to tell one story. I tend to tell it at conventions and things, not in local meetings, because it illustrates a point only. See, I always blamed my drinking and the problems that I came in conversation with on others. And that's true. In the early stages of your drinking, you're going to be in trouble from time to time, if you're going to be in difficulty with society, you will have to have another member of society cooperating. You know, if he hadn't made a left turn, I wouldn't have hit him. Which is true, but if I hadn't been bombed, I might have seen he was making the left turn a block earlier, you know, an unguided missile coming down the street here. And so you can blame each little incident on others. And the first insight I had into the idea that it might be my own problem came about in the following fashion. I used to drink almost exclusively to relax. And on the occasion I'm going to relate, I've been relaxed about a week. And I awoke from a horribly troubled sleep. I had a nightmarish dream of Dante's Inferno. Imps of the perverse were stabbing at me. Sulfur, brimstone, heat, and I staggered to my feet, and I was absolutely drenched with perspiration. And I thought, good Lord, you know, what's wrong? I even thought it might have something to do with drinking. But with that keen eye I have, I looked down and I saw, coming from this place of repose, this couch I had retired upon, was a thin spire of smoke. And I then realized what had happened. My family had gone to bed wherever it was they used to go at night. I had nodded off on this couch, apparently with a cigarette either in my hand or mouth, and it had fallen on the couch where that covering, that matting, that celluloid-type covering, whatever it is they have on the outside of the couch, it had burned its way through it into the tacking, into the matting. And then, having no oxygen down there to take flame, it had slowly begun to spread like embers until it covered the whole length of the couch. And I was greatly relieved to know that it wasn't my drinking. I had just been barbecued. So, commending myself on my perspicacity, I went into the kitchen, got a pitcher of water, and came back and tried to pour it into that tiny little hole. Achieving a remarkable cascade on the carpet, but little else. And so I knew more stringent measures were demanded. I went back into the kitchen, came back with a butcher knife, and I sliced the couch from one end to the other, opened it up, exposing the embers, and then indeed doused them with the cooling balm of this water, and put them to rest. The only thing was, it filled the room with acrid black smoke. You know, this has been 40 years ago or more, and I still remember standing there, looking down at that slashed and sodden mat, and realizing that almost to a certainty my wife was going to notice it. You know, she was a sharp-eyed woman. There was little that went on in that house that passed her ken, I'll tell you. And she was a good woman who would never do anything to challenge her husband's position in the household, assail his masculinity. On the other hand, I do confess there were times and moments of stress when she would say to me things that were unkind, cruel even, things that would cause her deep remorse later. She might say, "You drunken son of a bitch." And I wanted to spare her this. The only thing was that I didn't know what to do except get the couch out of the house. I mean, I realize she might vaguely remember there had been something on that side of the room, but out of sight, out of mind. The only trouble is, after a week's relaxation, I should be checking into a sanitarium rather than moving furniture. But with that Herculean strength, it comes only to the panic-stricken alcoholic. I somehow managed to cast that brute onto my shoulder and head out the front door. At that time, we were living on the second floor of an apartment building that had a very small little porch that had columns on it. I remember I virtually beat myself to death, tearing off those posts, trying to make the turn. But I got down finally to the foot of the stairs and looked about and realized that foresight had not been my long suit. Like Bobby Burns in his house, the best laid plans, because there's virtually no place that one might conceal a couch in a typical apartment patio. So I'm standing there. I should be in a hospital, but I'm moving furniture, legs trembling, and I remembered a creek about 5 miles away. And so I lurched to my car and I captured that Rudy straight atop it and got in and proceeded to drive to my selected depository. Now, all I've ever wanted in life was dignity. I have not traveled to disaster when I could face it with dignity. But I noticed this time, as I drove down the street, by now it was 6:30, 7:30, I don't know, it was the daylight anyhow, and there were people standing on the corners at the bus stops with briefcases and lunch pails and things. And as I drove along, their heads turned and followed my progress. Eyes, wide, jaws. Again. I thought, by golly, it doesn't take much to draw a crowd in California. I don't know. Until I passed in front of the auto dealership that had a large plate glass window that was dusty and acted like a mirror. And so I got a glimpse of what it was they were looking at. Here came a fellow, shabbily attired in a bathrobe, with about a week's growth of whiskers, and on top of his car rests a couch, which previously had lacked oxygen and then flames. The wind was going through it like a billows and rain 30, 40 feet in the air. Impossible, really, to find a way of blaming my sleeping wife and children for having imperiled my life, as they have. But that's more than enough of drinking. Let us just say that subsequently I moved beyond social drinking. In fact, in the latter stages of my drinking, I wasn't even getting into any trouble. I mean, how much trouble can you get into in a hotel room with a bottle of wine and a copy of Playboy? The maid doesn't step on you, you're reasonably safe. The only thing is you're dying down there. And then you think about AA. And you think about the 12 steps that you heard like the Chinese water torture at every meeting, but put aside as intellectually insulting, and that vision for you that they read many meetings. Isn't that a crazy vision? You know, visions usually are rather charming, attractive things. Our vision says that if you will do this, what they quaintly call putting your house in order, you'll meet with some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. Remember the first time I heard that, I thought, crunch. Crunch.
Crunch.
Crunch. I mean, of all the verbs in the English language that one might adopt to describe locomotion, they said crunch. I didn't ask for tricks, he skipped come a little. But my God, surely you can strive for dignity. Crunch! I mean, that's made out of Rudyard Kipling.
Boats, boats, boats marching up and down again, foot flogging over Africa. There's no end to the war.
When I was younger, I'd occasionally meet somebody say, you come with me, fella. I'm a door. Anybody say, you come with me, I'm a treasure. But the solution to all of those quibbles is to keep drinking. Booze is a great proselytizer in AA. It's what wears down the point on the intellectual's head through friction against the gutter if need be. And when you're lying in that hotel room, helpless and paralyzed, and you think of those people in AA crutching, you think, oh, boogie, I can't. That sounds like reading movement. And so you try the program, and of course it works. It always does. I don't see it fail for anybody. Hurt people try a program. I mean, everybody knows about AA. Police brutality being what it is, I warrant you can't lie down at high noon on Main Street down here without some cop giving you a list of meetings. You're dying, get away, pig. Everybody knows about AA. It's just that they come to a meeting to laugh a little bit, feel superior to the speakers, and go out and get drunk. Half the people in this room will be drunk with the beers on, I'm sure, if it's anywhere near an average meeting. And that's because breaking people try the steps. You know, the steps are the thing that distinguish our organization from others. The author said, these are the steps we took. You know, and remember, the book was written when they had only one guy sober more than, well, the author had only been sober 4 years. Most of us wouldn't even pay any attention to what a four-year-old thinks about anything. And the rest of them had 1 year. And 100 people sober 1 year. Now, they said these are the steps we took, assuming they weren't lying to us. When did they take them? Took them all the first year. They didn't know anything about long-term sobriety, 10, 15, 25, 30 years of sobriety. We down in L.A., we have gurus who can't find their asses by their hands, but they lead the multitude. You know, we have paramilitary organizations out on the west side. You know, your life is well ordered. You know, they took the steps, and they're very straight. They're even numbered to help the intellectual understand the sequence. One, two. Because from time immemorial, there have been people who recovered from alcoholism. If you want to read the book of our forefathers, my defense, A is kind of forefather of William James in his varieties of religious experience. He describes troubled, tormented souls, the twice born, he calls them, who individually, out in isolation, after suffering great torment, most of them are drinking them, like St. Augustine and the rest of them, and something happened to them so remarkable, they didn't know how to characterize it except as something coming from without. And they described it in accordance with whatever happened to be the religion of preference in whatever area they lived. If they were Catholics, they described it in Catholic terms, Buddhist terms, and so on. And what AA has done, because James was a pragmatist, he set down the things that occurred. He didn't care what manner they ascribed it to. He just said, what happened? What preceded this phenomenal experience? And then what happened afterwards? Now, what we have done, in a sense, is to take those things and put them into a mass production format. We have an assembly line. Instead of waiting for one in a thousand to be touched in isolation, we mass-produce spiritual experiences. Just like, you know, Henry Ford, before he came along with his assembly line, they made cars. The only thing is they were made by hand, and they were very rare and very expensive. But he had an assembly line. He started off with a bare chassis at one end, and he went down the line, and things were added. And within a matter of hours, out at the other end came a moving, operating vehicle that almost everyone could afford. That's what AA has done. It starts off at step one. You go down the line, adding and subtracting. And at the other end, having had a spiritual experience, a spiritual awakening, as a result of the steps, not before, you change. And it works. I've never seen it fail for anybody. Now, most people won't do it. I mean, if anybody here goes out and drinks again, and somebody says you tried AA, unless you've gotten down on your knees, prayed for insight, and taken a plume and paper and written out an inventory which you've read to somebody, and somebody says that you tried AA, be candid, say, hell no. Never dawned on me to try this program. I went to meetings, laughed at the speakers, but I have no idea whether any of this worked or not, because I totally refused to try it. Why do I say things like that, really? If you were that capable of being honest, you wouldn't be drunk. Why do I say a thing like that? Anyhow, AA does work. It really does. You take the steps, and they work. They always do. And why are we so frightened about taking it? I wonder. How do we resist? You know, the worst thing that can happen to a person who tried this program is that they spend the balance of their life in full possession of their faculties. And we only get one trip on this little blue-white globe we call the Earth, so far as we know. And it's very short. It's very brief. No, and you wouldn't miss it. Oh, I guess that's a threat to be in full possession of your faculties, considering what they're like. And you won't be able to be hip and slick and cool anymore. I mean, you won't be able to say, hey, what happened, man? Shit, don't know. I really should pardon a scatological word. I don't usually talk like that on Sunday morning, especially. But it's true, it does work. It actually does. And then you're facing life. Now, it is extraordinary what life is like sober, working the program. It's going to be better than almost all of the non-alcoholics, except those who found some kind of a spiritual program as well, are ever going to know. But that doesn't mean you're free from all pain and suffering and anguish and tension. Of course you're not. The world has remained the old world yet. Things are going to happen. You're going to be frustrated, disappointed, abandoned, rejected, ill. People you love are going to die. All the things that flesh are heir to are going to happen to us. Why should the world rise up on tippy toes because I stopped sucking on each other? The universe doesn't tread lightly in order to avoid upsetting my tender psyche. All of the things that are going to happen, happen. But we face them now. Who would need a higher power? Who would need a program if everything went smoothly at all times? Of course these things happen. But most of the time it's going to be abundantly pleasant because when good things occur, you won't feel guilty because you'll learn them. You won't feel, oh God, if they find out about me, they're really going to punish me for this success. And as I say, certain things turn out unhappily from time to time. My life was all set up. I had been married for about 15 years on the program, and I suddenly found myself a bachelor with a 13-year-old teenage boy to try to raise. And I had not planned that sort of thing. I'd like to tell you that as a result of our beautiful program, I was able to talk to this teenager one-to-one. But any man who says he talks to the teenage son one-to-one lies about other things, too. Of course you don't talk to a teenager. What the hell? They have nothing to talk about. They are going through a period of absolute anguish and horror. There is no question but that the teenage years are the worst thing you're ever going to experience in your entire existence. The testosterone rushes on, and you're totally crazy. And you have no words. They have no verbal means of communication. No, they can't speak. I remember my girls were going through it, and they would come home in tears. I was talking to our Mrs. Bernie here, who was telling her she got an 11-year-old. You know, my girls would come home, and they'd be in tears, and I'd say, what's wrong, honey? And they'd say, that boy. What do you mean? What did he do? He looked at me. How did he look at you? He looked at me funny. What do you mean? Funny lewd? Funny aggressive? Funny hostile? What kind of funny? Funny, funny! They're dying, and they have no verbal means of speech. I mean, they have records that they have put their primordial grunts to music of some sort, and they play it very loudly, but I mean, human speech is beyond them. Hell, I never saw this kid. He lived in the front of the house. I lived in the rear. I used to throw money in the hall. But with our program, I survived, and so did he, and he graduated from college a while back, and, he went on, and after I bounced around in that house thinking no good can come of this but break my heart in two, along came a young lady who saw fit to join this minor menagerie that we have in the household. She has 21 years sobriety. I don't monkey with newcomers, but... But she came on the program so young that she still seems like a child to me. And yet she seems to like me. And that's good. And she doesn't object to old age creeping on her at night. And that's better. That's been almost 10 years ago, and we've had a very full and active life. My work had also gone to seed about that same period of time, and I did not look upon it as a happy and successful thing. And yet about 7 or 8 years ago, as some of you know, the governor called me and told me he was appointing me to the appellate bench. As far as I know, the highest judicial office ever held by a non-alcoholic. And I remember back at the time to when I first came around the program and was trying to get a job in the legal profession. Went to interview with the large law firms and told them some of my stories, and they were aghast. I hadn't yet realized that the non-alcoholic doesn't see the humor in some of our little... Time I got drunk and threw my mother-in-law down the steps. Intoxicated, fell after, got a double hernia. Thought maybe I was too subtle, so I told him by the time I was in 4-point restraint and vomited straight up. He recoiled in horror. And I said to him, look, I'm not asking you to recommend me. To recommend you? To recommend you? I wouldn't offer your name for consideration. No attorney in the history of this nation has ever done the things that you've done or had happen to him, the things that have happened to you. But I suggest you should go into the countryside. Forget the law. Try to find your help in simple labors. Because when we send men into the courtroom, they represent strength in the face of adversity, honest, determined character. Send you to represent us? Never. You know what happens now when members of that law firm come into a courtroom where I am? They stand up and they remain standing until I tell them they can be seated. All power to the powerless. And yet I really haven't changed all that much. I don't drink, of course, which is the greatest change that can come into the life of an alcoholic. I've learned to laugh at myself, which if you don't do will cause you to miss the greatest generation in the greatest joke in your own generation. But basically, I haven't changed all that much. I of course, A permeates everything you do. We learn to speak. We have catch words that allow us to identify each other. You always know when you're getting near an AA meeting, you think bumper stickers, easy does it. And we use words. You're in a line at the grocery store, and no, first things first. Although, you can't take it all too seriously. There's the old bit about that one guy that bumper sticker says, honk, if you're a friend of Bill W.'s. If you honk at him, the guy's, but we do have those certain things. I find myself, I even work them into my decisions. Anytime I decide to publish a decision, it appears in every law library throughout the country, and I will find I slip in a terminology sometimes that almost, you know, for example, we use arcane language in the law, and we will say a person's contract, I mean, his person's complaint sounds in contract, or it sounds in tort or equity. I don't know why we say it sounds in, but what they're trying to do is to state a cause of action in those particular fields of the law, and I suppose Blackstone said it 400 years ago in somebody's ethics grammar, and so we've been repeating it. And I had a decision I filed some time back. It has the words in it saying, no point would be served by analyzing a fellow's complaint in detail. Suffice it to say that it sounds in self-pity and resentment, but states no cause of action, no law. You forget something. One I didn't even mean to publish, but it got published for another reason. But, you know, I sometimes talk about what a great father I was. And then, A, they understand it when I say, every Sunday I used to take my children out for a drunk drive. Remember writing the decision again. The pellet one morning while out for a drunk drive. That's called in the newspaper. I even had filed one not too long back which said, in law, as in life, half measures avail us nothing. My colleagues say, where do you get those expressions? I don't know. But this is really what life is all about, is living. And this is why I want to be sober. I don't have too much time left. I really don't. I started beginning talking about age, but it's literally true. I don't have that much time left, and I want to know what is going on every single precious minute of it. When you're young, hell, you're immortal. Hey, you know, young people, they're not concerned about. One of my kids during the testosterone rush, you know, he came to me and said, you know, Dad, if I should ever die, what the hell do you mean, punk? You know, it's not a hypothesis, it's reality. I'm staring at it. I've given up the thought of suicide. How much time would I really save when you get right now? I want to know what's going on out there, even on the very mean gut question days. We don't have that much time left. This is what it is about. If there's anything that you want to do to improve society, to strike a blow for justice, now's the time to do it. You know, in the tomb, no one raises his hand for righteousness' sake. If you want to do anything tender and loving and gentle, again, this is the time to do it. What is it the poet says? The grave, it is a fine and private place, but none, I think, do there give grace. I mean, this is what it's all about. This is the time for it. I really recommend it. My life has been a miracle, no question about it. If you were to put my story on the TV soap opera, people would laugh you off the air. There's no way to go from the lockups and the pits to the court system. I sometimes sit on our Supreme Court, seven of us in our black robes, six deadly serious, one of them. Each of us in our own way experiences a miracle just as great. I heard a woman speak the other night who, she had been a victim of child abuse. I mean, her parents had abused her as kids, and she had abused her own children until she came onto the program, and now they had developed a relationship and love and friendliness. I would far rather see someone break that cycle of child abuse than I would see somebody appointed a judge. See, the miracles here are absolutely enormous. Mine in particular, I got to get off here. I'm trying to find a rising note of hope. Somebody over here said, I think he just died drunk. But they're building this state building as part of the Los Angeles redevelopment project. And this new state building, a big towering thing, is going to be right in the middle of Skid Row between 3rd and 4th on Main Street. I'm running down that LA Marathon and saw it going up already. If that's still in office, I mean, if I'm still in office when they complete it, I assume I should hopefully will be, I'll be able to take a wine bottle and throw it out my chamber's window and hit where I used to sell blood. If I get a little lost on it, I'll be able to hit Clancy down at the midnight mission. We've enjoyed our trip. I really hope there will be those who want to live and want to see what's going on. So this is what it's about. This is what it's about. Thank you.